It's time for KUOW's The Record. Good Monday afternoon to you. I'm Bill Radke, and we're going to start this hour about where we left off last week. We had the fatal shooting at a Seattle homeless encampment. The mayor addressed homelessness. The one-night count showed a jump in people living outdoors in King County. This story is about what it is like to be homeless. Lisa Sawyer lost her home more than 3 years ago. Now, by day, she sells the Real Change street newspaper downtown. By night, her situation gets less predictable. Shelters are not an option because she has a boyfriend and there are no couple shelters in Seattle. So sometimes they stay with friends, sometimes in motels, sometimes they're on the streets. This is Lisa's story in her words.
Come get your Real Change, folks. It's still hot and still fresh. It's a brand new one.
My name is Lisa Sawyer. I'm a Real Change vendor of the year. I've been selling for the past 2 years, been homeless is over 3 years. I'm also a homeless advocate, and I fight for a change in Seattle. We're over here at the waterfront, right next door to the aquarium. There's a little park. We sleep right in the corner where there's a table and a bench because we feel more safe and secure. You don't have to worry about getting your stuff jacked behind you. You can see what's right in front of you.
Real Change, folks, they're brand new today. Would you like one today, young lady?
People been out here for different reasons. Some people can't afford rent. Some people got house fires. Anything is possible. Me, it was a house fire. That's the reason why I came homeless, and I've been looking ever since. I just want a place and be done with homelessness because right now I'm exhausted. It's tough out here. I'm ready to be inside. I want a place that I could call home. And I want to cook again. I want to watch TV again. I want to do my laundry. I just want to be normal. You can have friends again. You don't have to feel embarrassed you're homeless. Because you get a lot of people looking down upon you when you have all different types of bags. Even more than one backpack. I apply for apartments online. I even talk to people. Not a lot of people want to talk to me. I think a lot of people just want people that work for Amazon, people work for Boeing, Microsoft, those type of people. The ones that actually they know that could afford it. If you tell them your homelessness or one suspect if you're homeless, they might not even get back to you or anything like that. I think this is such important for me getting inside because it's getting more dangerous out here. And you could get shot. You could get raped. You could get mugged. It's the hardest thing you will ever do. And it doesn't have an expiration date. I'm just hoping that I'll get that place soon because I'm scared. I don't want to be out here any longer.
That's Lisa Sawyer. She sells the street newspaper Real Change. In fact, she was the paper's vendor of the year last year. She hasn't had a place to live for more than 3 years. And you can learn more about Lisa's story at our website, KUOW.org. Now, whether you love or hate these presidential candidates, don't you kind of sympathize with them for the way that campaigns turn their personal lives inside out? Well, that's true in local politics, too. Seattle's mayor, Ed Murray, was asked to run for the state legislature by a dying friend, Washington's first openly gay politician, State Senator Cal Anderson. At a StoryCorps booth in Seattle's New Holly neighborhood, Murray and his husband, Michael Shiosaki, told the story.
It was also the height of the HIV/AIDS crisis, and Cal was trying to pass a bill to grant civil rights, ending discrimination in employment and housing and financial transactions to members of our community. And regrettably, he got fairly ill with HIV/AIDS in 1995. And do you remember when we were out at Whidbey Island, and he told us that he wasn't going to make it? And he asked me, did I want to consider being the next person from our community to take his seat?
I do remember that. I do remember that weekend out at the cabin at Whidbey Island. It was really kind of astounding that I think on some level, Cal Anderson didn't think he. I think he thought he would be fine. He would survive. But at some point, I think he realized that it was time that he had to pass the baton.
I remember after they left and we kind of stood there looking out at out of Puget Sound, and I think we both knew that if I said yes to this, it would dramatically change where our life was going, our lives were going.
But I think at that point, I didn't know what it meant. I had no idea what it meant, how it would change our lives. I mean,
what did it mean? How did it change our lives?
Well, I think we, you know, our little private lives became suddenly public. I mean, when you run for public office, you put yourself out there in front of everyone. And so, I mean, that's how it really changed our lives. We didn't have that little private life we used to have for, you know.
Yeah, and I think it was, I realize we've given up a lot of privacy a lot of time together, particularly in winter nights when I was at the state capitol in Olympia. And we went from an experience of constantly losing on civil rights, losing in trying to prevent DOMA, our state's Defense of Marriage Act, year after year after year, until the day I entered in 95 till the day we finally won the Civil Rights Bill in 2006, and then, of course, the Marriage Equality Bill in 2012. And just to mention those things sound, wow, those are big deals, but if you think about all the losses, all the pain, so what are the memories you remember of those moments?
Well, you know, I remember some of the scary moments being down in the hearings at down in the state capitol, where there were people that were so angry about potentially this civil rights bill passing, and they were so angry and trying to vilify other people. I mean, it was one of the scariest. I mean, it was the first time I'd been to the Capitol in that kind of heated atmosphere where there were threats of violence and there was anger and hate from people standing right next to you. I mean, it's a very vivid memory I still have of those terrible, terrible public hearings in Olympia. There's the downside, but then, you know, you go a decade and a half later, it's the great victories when the civil rights bill was passed by the legislature. I mean, it was moments of just incredible joy in the community. So, I mean, that's the flip side of years and years of hard work.
So I thought it was so great that you were standing in the wings of the House chamber a few feet from where I was sitting as the civil rights bill passed. And then 6 years later, you were standing a few feet in the Senate chamber as a marriage vote was taking place. And you and the governor, Christine Gregoire, were standing there side by side. And I remember looking over at you, two of you, but of course you in particular, as we finally saw this state be the first state to overturn DOMA and make marriage the law of the state. Those were really incredibly moving moments that we were there together.
Yeah, it really doesn't get any better than that. They were just amazing moments in our lives together.
That's Seattle's Mayor Ed Murray and self-described first gentleman Michael Shiosaki. And they recorded that at the StoryCorps booth in Seattle last summer. And you can hear more local StoryCorps conversations because there's a listening event coming up on Thursday night in Seattle's New Holly neighborhood. So go find out more. Just go to KUOW.org and click on StoryCorps. Now let's hear some rock music of a more modern and possibly more offensive kind. Doesn't sound offensive, but then we haven't said the group's name. In 2007, Portland bassist Simon Tam wanted to start a band that celebrates his Asian heritage, and he wanted a name that encapsulated that pride and at the same time took back the power of a common racial slur.
I asked a friend of mine, I said, what's something you think that all Asians have in common. We all want to kind of address some of these stereotypes. And they immediately said slanted eyes. And I thought, you know, this is really interesting because we could talk about our own slant on life, our own perspective, if you will.
That's right. He named his band The Slants. And eventually Simon went to register that name for a trademark. And the government told him no.
They said it's because there's a law against things that are considered scandalous, immoral, and disparaging. And they said the slants is an inherent racial slur, and it is considered disparaging to persons of Asian descent. And what's interesting about this law is they said a substantial composite of the reference group has to find it offensive. In other words, Asian Americans have to, on the whole, be outraged over it. But they did not find a single Asian who was upset. But they did find an UrbanDictionary.com definition, a Wikipedia entry, and a photo of Miley Cyrus holding her eyes back in a slant eye gesture.
Did they include that in the letter?
Yeah, yeah. It was part of their evidence. When my attorney showed this to me, I thought it was a practical joke. I was like, this must be some kind of clerical error. Do they not know we're actually Asian and that we play Asian festivals and we do anti-racism work, sometimes on behalf of the government? And he said, I don't think they get it. So we decided to fight back. We had letters of support from Asian American leaders. We had Asian American press examples, and we showed how our community was using it and was completely fine with it.
Do you have any idea how often the government denies trademarks because names are supposedly offensive?
Apparently, it doesn't come up that often, but it does come up. And the thing is, it's subjectively applied. So, for example, there's over 800 trademarks out there for the term slant. Mine is the only one in all of U.S. history to be denied for being racist towards Asians. And we asked them, we said, well, why is it offensive in our case? And they said, it's because you're Asian. Not only that, they said I was too Asian. They said that we have Asian imagery all over our website. In other words, there's photos of Asian people on the band's website, which is deeply ironic since it's our face. We can't actually change our ethnicity.
Okay, so you disagreed with the government, but you could have let it go. Why did you launch this big, what turned out to be a big, long, expensive fight over the name The Slant?
Sure. And believe me, I originally was thinking of letting it go. It was my attorney who convinced me otherwise, because he said, you know, after we were combing through the laws and who was up against it, we found that it was disproportionately applied to people of color, and for those in the LGBTQ community, people who are kind of reappropriating terms, using it for empowerment, the government said, no, that's not acceptable. We can't legislate that. And they were using it to deny us rights, to suppress our speech.
So you appealed up to the federal court. And last month, the federal court said, you win. Your 80s synth band can be The Slants, despite your faces. Why? Why did they tell you now that's okay?
Well, they ruled the law that we were fighting is unconstitutional. And they said that it's because trademark registrations are a form of speech. And for the government to deny it based on what they feel is inappropriate is considered a way to abridge free speech rights for individuals or organizations.
How did that feel to win that case?
Honestly, after over half a decade of fighting, it was pretty unreal. Not only did we win, but we helped revoke this law and expanded the First Amendment, which is just something most people don't think about doing. Certainly, most people who just start a band don't think about doing.
So now, hey, people can dance to The Slants and it's trademarkable. But here's what I want to know. You're reappropriating this language. You're taking back this insult, and others do similar things like that. But on the other hand, doesn't your court victory open the door for actual racists to trademark names meant in an actual racist way?
True. It does allow some people to use speech that would be considered inappropriate. However, the law wasn't doing a good job of preventing that anyway. We know that hate speech exists, whether or not people have a valid trademark registration.
Are you okay with any word being trademarked? I mean, the N-word obviously comes to mind, especially on a KKK t-shirt or business or organization?
I don't think we should be drawing the line of morality on trademark registrations. If the government really cared about using trademark registrations to prevent hate speech, then they should strip the trademark registrations away from the KKK and other white supremacist groups. They have never done so. So I don't think it's just at any particular one word. Because if you take that word away from everybody, you're also taking it away from the communities that need it, who can use it as a form of empowerment to gather power and to create social change.
I just wonder how this would come across to the person who authored that language or supported this language that, no, we're not going to trademark racist slurs. And you're telling them that that application was actually more racist than the problem they were fighting?
It's because we're expecting trademark examiners to have a complete understanding of the entire lexicon of the English dictionary and to understand the cultural experiences of every marginalized group in this country. It's an impossible standard. You know, the trademark office did say, well, you can't represent the views of all Asian Americans in this country. And I said, that's true. That's why we did a national independent survey, which said over 90% of the Asian Americans believed it in our cause. But they did not bother asking a single Asian American in the entire decision-making process. They had over half a decade to do so.
What do your fans think of the name of your band?
Our fans love it. But
what does it mean to them?
It means different things for different people. And one of the reasons that we continue to fight this was that early on, when I first started this band, I used to get these handwritten letters and emails and messages on MySpace, which gives you an idea of how far back this goes, from Asian American youth saying, thank you for giving me reason to be proud of my heritage. I was once ashamed of having these slanted eyes, but now I think it's cool. And now I'm proud of myself, and I believe that I can do something like play music. That's powerful.
Do you find it's more Caucasians who are bothered by the name slants?
Those are the only ones that have complained so far.
Why do you think that is?
I think people like to be offended on our behalf. I think we're so accustomed to being politically sensitive, or politically correct, and thinking that that is a form of protecting our communities rather than giving our communities actual voice.
We're having a serious conversation. Your music is really fun. Your album names are hilarious. Newest album is called
Something Slanted This Way Comes.
Another one was called Slant Slants Revolution.
Yeah, little homage to DDR.
So, is any part of you having fun with this, including poking at people who maybe don't get it?
I think it's okay to have fun. I think irony, wit, and humor can be an excellent way to neuter malice. I mean,
to neuter malice.
Yeah. And I think that countless comedians that are out there, they show us that it's okay, because when you are able to share laughter with others, you can actually often create connections that otherwise wouldn't be there. Some of the greatest forms of social change are done through humor and not necessarily through anger or frustration.
That's Simon Tam, founder of the Portland rock band The Slants. The government now has to decide whether to file an appeal with the United States Supreme Court. And if they do, it'll be a few more years until The Slants can get a trademark. Even so, their new album called Something Slanted This Way Comes is out in April. And they're going to go on tour this year in Asia, where Simon Tam says slants is not considered a racial slur. KUOW is The Record. Good afternoon. I'm Bill Radke. Seattle's economy rocked last year. Are we due for a drop-off? Seattle Times economics columnist John Talton writes about the chance of a recession coming and what that might mean for the Seattle boom. Hiya, John.
Hey, Bill.
What's wrong with you, man? Can't you hear the dance music? We're partying here forever, right?
Well, Americans are natural bright-siders, and Seattleites especially so, but there is a lot of bad stuff happening out there in the world, and there is a chance of a global downturn. And if it happens, we will not avoid it.
What's the bad stuff?
Well, China is in trouble. We don't really know how bad because the official statistics are not good. But China's growth that we've counted on for 25, 30 years has slowed way down. And China might even face a recession, which would be of enormous consequence. One of the reasons oil prices are so low is because demand has fallen off in China, and so this has caused a bubble to pop in commodities. This is spooking the stock markets. But it's not just China. All over the emerging markets, the BRICS, Brazil, Russia, India, South Africa, are facing slowing, contracting economies. And this is in an environment where we already have very slow growth. The United States, with the slow growth we've had since the Great Recession, has been leading the way. And did I mention the EU zone, the Eurozone and the EU, trouble continues there. Then there's the danger of a tech bubble, especially in Silicon Valley, overvalued tech stocks. Investors are very nervous. The January effect used to mean if January went really well, then the rest of the year was going to do good. Well, our January effect was not good.
So I understand the worry about a tech bubble. All the other stuff you mentioned, I mean, it seems like we've been relatively isolated from those kind of problems in Seattle.
Well, we have an amazingly diverse economy, and that economy has seen us through a lot of troubles. The Great Recession arrived here late, but it did arrive here. Having said that, we have some vulnerable spots. I mean, one is Boeing, which announced last week that it was going to cut back on production of the 777.
Yeah, I saw that.
And so that has profound implications. We've already lost several thousand Boeing jobs since 2013. And there are very few places in the country that have such a robust manufacturing sector with so many tens of thousands, 79,000 high-paid manufacturing jobs, and then you ripple that out to the entire aerospace cluster. If there's a slowdown in orders, if orders fall through or they're postponed, then that's a real vulnerability.
What's Boeing's problem? I would think, for one thing, cheap oil, good for an airplane maker?
Well, China is one of Boeing's problems.
Back to China.
Everything goes back to China in a lot of ways, but again, the emerging markets, which are potentially big jet customers. And then you have the situation where Americans' wages have not gone up, and a lot of people got jobs, but they weren't better jobs than the ones that they replaced. And so air traffic is not necessarily benefiting from that. Now, the airlines are doing okay thanks to lower fuel, so good news for Alaska. But as far as orders for new airplanes, we're going to have to wait and see if those hold up.
Okay, finally, John Talton with Seattle Times. You could always come in here any month, any year, and list possible concerns about the economy. But what do you think are the odds of a slowdown? How big of a slowdown?
If I knew that, I wouldn't need the newspaper gig. Okay. But on the other hand, they are getting up there. They're between 10%, the Fed says, 65%, the Citigroup says.
That's 65%. That sounds kind of significant.
It is.
Okay. And one more thing, you noted in your column, a New York Times piece about businesses, American businesses, hoarding $2 trillion in cash. What's going on
there?
That's
right. Well, nobody is quite sure. But one of the theories is that they are concerned that something big is coming. Now, what that big might be, nobody is quite sure. The big might be a technological leap that then they can jump in and invest in, but it also might be this continued secular stagnation that holds the economy back, or an economic shock.
Seattle Times economics columnist John Talton. Good afternoon. With KUOW's The Record, I'm Bill Radke. On a hot summer night in 2009, three people's lives changed forever in Seattle's South Park neighborhood. One woman died. Another survived a brutal attack. A young man is now spending his life in prison.
This book is about the three lives that intersected that night. So the life of Teresa Butts, the life of Jennifer Hopper, and the life of their attacker, Isaiah Kalebu, and what those lives and paths have to teach.
That's Pulitzer Prize winner Eli Sanders. He tells their story in his new book, While the City Slept. We started our conversation with that July night.
Two women, Teresa Butts and Jennifer Hopper, were living together in in a small red house, planning to be married at the end of the summer. And in the middle of the summer, a man named Isaiah Kalebu crawled in through a window of their home and attacked both of them, raped both of them, attempted to kill both of them, and succeeded after some fighting back by Teresa in killing Teresa, and attempted to kill Jennifer, who was able to escape into the street in front of her house.
You get a sense in your book about how she has forgiven Isaiah Kalebu, and you get a sense even in her testimony about some kind of, unbelievably, a kind of humanity in that room that night.
An incredible grace. I think, on the part of both Teresa Butts and Jennifer Hopper. And yes, humanity towards someone who was doing really unspeakable things to them. There was a moment when Isaiah, during the crime, you know, he attacked them multiple times, and between attacks, they had conversations sometimes, and Jennifer and Teresa were trying to prevail on him to go. And one of these conversations went in the direction of Isaiah asking at one point whether they might have been friends, because he started to see from what they were saying that they were very good people. They were on the board of a homeless advocacy organization. And Teresa's response was, maybe we still could be. And he asked her whether she thought there was any good in him. And this is after he had done terrible things to her and to her fiance, Jennifer. And she put her hand on his chest in Jennifer's telling of this at the trial during Jennifer's testimony. She described Teresa putting her hand on Isaiah's chest and saying, I know there's some good in there somewhere.
Did Jennifer want us to know Isaiah's story as well?
I don't know whether at the time that she testified in 2011, she did, or she ever envisioned, or I ever envisioned, for that matter, a book like this. But over the course of working on the book and over the course of her work over these years since the crime and since the trial, she has become interested in his path. She has found forgiveness for him, and a forgiveness that helps her to be whole, and a curiosity, as she puts it in the book, what happened to him? How could somebody become someone who would do something like this?
How did our system fail Isaiah Kalebu?
In the years when Isaiah most needed help and intervention from our publicly funded mental health system, that system was under incredible strain because of budget cuts enacted in the wake of the Great Recession. When state lawmakers needed to shave money off the state budget, they slashed social services first. And so in the year that this crime occurred, a $24 million cut, for example, was taking effect in the state mental health services budget. And there are consequences to those decisions. And you can see in Isaiah's path through our mental health system that he was not watched as closely as he should have been, for example. There's a point where he ended up free on certain conditions from a judge, one of them being that he attend his community treatment appointments. Now, he was going to community treatment because he's not a person of great means at a publicly funded community treatment center. These places are overworked, underpaid, overwhelmed. And when he stopped showing up, the center didn't communicate with the judge to tell him that they hadn't seen him in a while. And the judge, who is also in a system that is underfunded, overwhelmed, didn't communicate with the community treatment center. And so months went by where Isaiah was not seen, at a time when psychiatrists who had evaluated him had warned that he really needed to be regularly seen or else he would be a danger.
And in that way, this book is not just about Jennifer, Teresa, and Isaiah. It's about our mental health system.
Which means it's about us, because we elect the people who make the decisions about how to fund or how to reform our mental health system. But the context is underfunded, overwhelmed systems that don't have time to be in constant communication with each other about an individual who really needs constant care.
The surviving victim of this crime, Jennifer Hopper, she lives here. You've spent a lot of time with her, spent a lot of time going over that horrible night. What is it like for you to try to tell such an unspeakable story, but speak about it for years now for you?
It's not been easy. I want to clarify that the book is not, you know, a book-length version of that night. It really, the vast majority of it is the path toward that night, the path taken by Isaiah Kalebu and Jennifer Hopper and Teresa Butts, and then the paths onward. But it was not easy to even sit just with those paths, knowing the outcome. And one of the tools I used, and I don't know if this was a good tool, but it's what helped get me through. You know, I saw every day in my work people who were living with the consequences of this crime in far more profound ways than I was. Jennifer, her forgiveness for Isaiah, Isaiah's family, their ability to go on despite the real difficult challenges they had long before this crime occurred, and, you know, their incredible pain at not having been able to get their son more help or prevail on other people to help him. And to see and know that they were going on, and the family of Teresa Butts was going on and doing remarkable, purposeful things. Teresa's family and Jennifer Hopper have created something called the Angel Band Project, which is dedicated to helping survivors of sexual violence through music therapy. They were putting on concerts at the time that I was working on this book. They still are. And so you see that and you think, okay, I'm having a bad day, you know, or whatever. This is a hard day, but you know what? They've got bad days. And look at what they're doing. They're making something good out of this. Hopefully I can make something worthwhile out of these stories.
That's Stranger Associate Editor Eli Sanders, the author of While the City Slept. Jennifer Hopper survived the night Isaiah Kalebu attacked her and her fiancé. And as Eli Sanders just said, she has managed to make something good out of the events of that night. But now a lot of people only know Jennifer as the person who survived that attack. KUOW's Katie Sewell asked Jennifer Hopper what it's like to be forever associated with that terrible night and how people treat her differently now.
That's a great question. I'm going to answer it by telling you my favorite quote by John Irving, The Cider House Rules, and it's been my favorite quote for probably 15 years. Sometimes when we are labeled, when we are branded, our brand becomes our calling. And at the time, I never knew that that would have anything to do with my life. Probably way before Eli branded me as the bravest woman in Seattle, without a doubt, people had that to say. It was like, you're so strong, you're so brave around such a bad thing that happened. And I'm not going to say that that's not true. I do own that my response to what happened to Teresa and what happened to me has been strong and as graceful as I can be, and maybe even brave. But it's really interesting when you start getting known for that, it really does become like a beacon for how to be and how to behave in the world. I actually have a higher calling for myself. You know, I really want to be counted on for being all of those things that people say that I am. You're meeting someone who has also survived something terrible, not just like sexual violence, maybe their own death of a partner or of a child or of someone dear to them. And there's this, like, you can know me. It's like this invitation. Those, in many ways, are my favorite moments, because it's not that often that with relative strangers, you get to have unspoken intimacy.
How do you feel about Isaiah now?
First of all, I love that you used his first name, because that's a commitment that I have. For a long time, I called him Kalebu. I knew I was doing it because there was something scary about his first name. The way I think about him, I am glad that he is in prison and isn't free to feasibly hurt anyone else. I know that when I read the book, there was a passage in which it became clear to me that one of the things that has been taken from him by being in prison, and this had never occurred to me before as possible, he will probably never experience love in his life. Like, he won't be allowed to. And when I knew that, I felt sad. And it was another example in which I knew that whatever forgiveness has cultivated over the last 6 years is real and true and not just something I made up. I'm always worried it's going to just be something that I'm making up to feel better. But I knew it was true because I thought, that's sad. He will never have that experience. And maybe that's part of what prison is. I hope that he finds some sense of peace and routine and health.
The book, you know, is about three people colliding. And let's say that collision was going to happen regardless. Does that ever make you wish that you had not met Teresa?
In the aftermath of everything that's happened, of course I've been somebody who's looked at faith and questioned my beliefs and wondered, was I naive to think that if we're good people, good things will happen to us and all of that? And I don't have good answers for all of that yet, but I can't help but believe that we're all here for a reason. If what happened to her had to happen, that I was here to hold her hand through it, and I would do it over and over and over again. And while it hurts, it has made me a better person.
Jennifer Hopper, one of the subjects of Eli Sanders' new book, While the City Slept, that looks at the lives of Hopper and Teresa Butts and Isaiah Kalebu. Kalebu attacked Jennifer and Teresa in their home in 2009, killing Teresa, nearly killing Jennifer Hopper. And you can hear from Jennifer and the author of that book, Eli Sanders, when they're interviewed on stage on Wednesday night by KUOW's Marcy Silman at Town Hall Seattle. Again, that's this Wednesday night at 7:30 right here on KUOW Seattle. I'm Bill Radke. Glad you have tuned in today. I hope you'll be listening this evening because finally, after much speculation, we actually get presidential votes tonight from Iowa. So at 5 o'clock, we bring you a live special from WNYC and Iowa Public Radio. At 6 o'clock, live special coverage from NPR. And, of course, reactions from all over and analysis tomorrow morning on KUOW's Morning News Magazine.